June 2, 1910. When the shadow of the sash appeared on the curtains, it was between 7 and 8 o'clock, and then I was in time again, hearing the watch. It was Grandfather's, and when Father gave it to me, he said, "I give you the mausoleum of all hope and desire. It's rather excruciatingly apt that you will use it to gain the reducto absurdum of all human experience, which can fit your individual needs no better than it fitted his or his father's. I give it to you not that you may remember time, but that you might forget it now and then for a moment, and not spend all your breath trying to conquer it. Because no battle is ever won," he said. "They are not even fought. The field only reveals to man his own folly and despair. And victory is an illusion of philosophers and fools." It was propped against the collar box, and I lay listening to it. Hearing it, that is. I don't suppose anybody ever deliberately listens to a watch or a clock. You don't have to. You can be oblivious to the sound for a long while. Then in a second of ticking, it can create in the mind unbroken the long diminishing parade of time you didn't hear. Like Father said, down the long and lonely light rays you might see Jesus walking like. And the good Saint Francis that said little sister Death, that never had a sister. Through the wall I heard Shreve's bed springs and then his slippers on the floor hishing. I got up and went to the dresser and slid my hand along it and touched the watch and turned it face down and went back to bed. But the shadow of the sash was still there, and I had learned to tell almost to the minute. So I'd have to turn my back to it, feeling the eyes animals used to have in the back of their heads when it was on top, itching. It's always the idle habits you acquire which you will regret. Father said that. That Christ was not crucified. He was worn away by a minute clicking of little wheels. That had no sister. And so, as soon as I knew I couldn't see it, I began to wonder what time it was. Father said that constant speculation regarding the position of mechanical hands on an arbitrary dial, which is a symptom of mind function. Excrement, Father said, like sweating. And I saying, "All right. Wonder. Go on and wonder." If it had been cloudy, I could have looked at the window, thinking what he said about idle habits, thinking it would be nice for them down at New London if the weather held up like this. Why shouldn't it? The month of brides, the voice that breathed. She ran right out of the mirror, out of the banked scent. Roses, roses. Mr. and Mrs. Jason Richmond Compson announced the marriage of... Roses. Not virgins like dogwood, milkweed. I said, "I have committed incest, Father," I said. "Roses, cunning and serene. If you attend Harvard 1 year, but don't see the boat race, there should be a refund. Let Jason have it. Give Jason a year at Harvard." Shreve stood in the door, putting his collar on, his glasses glinting rosily as though he had washed them with his face. "You taking a cut this morning? Is it that late?" He looked at his watch. "Bell in 2 minutes." "I didn't know it was that late." He was still looking at the watch, his mouth shaping. "I'll have to hustle. I can't stand another cut. The dean told me last week." He put the watch back into his pocket. Then I quit talking. "You'd better slip on your pants and run," he said. He went out. I got up and moved about, listening to him through the wall. He entered the sitting room toward the door. "Aren't you ready yet?" "Not yet. Run along. I'll make it." He went out. The door closed. His feet went down the corridor. Then I could hear the watch again. I quit moving around and went to the window and drew the curtains aside and watched them running for chapel, the same ones fighting the same heaving coat sleeves, the same books and flapping collars flushing past like debris on a flood. And Spode, calling Shreve my husband. "Ah, let him alone," Shreve said. "If he's got better sense than to chase after the little dirty sluts, whose business?" "In the South you are ashamed of being a virgin. Boys, men, they lie about it, because it means less to women," Father said. He said it was men invented virginity, not women. Father said it's like death, only a state in which the others are left. And I said, "But to believe it doesn't matter," and he said, "That's what's so sad about anything, not only virginity, And I said, why couldn't it have been me and not her who is unvirgin? And he said, that's why that's sad, too. Nothing is even worth the changing of it. And Shreve said, if he's got better sense than to chase after the little dirty sluts. And I said, did you ever have a sister? Did you? Did you? Spode was in the middle of them like a terrapin in a street full of scuttering dead leaves, his collar about his ears, moving at his customary unhurried walk. He was from South Carolina, a senior. It was his club's boast that he never ran for chapel, and had never got there on time, and had never been absent in 4 years, and had never made either chapel or first lecture with a shirt on his back and socks on his feet. About 10 o'clock he'd come in Thompson's, get 2 cups of coffee, sit down and take his socks out of his pocket and remove his shoes and put them on while the coffee cooled. About noon you'd see him with a shirt and collar on like anybody else. The others passed him running, but he never increased his pace at all. After a while the quad was empty. A sparrow slanted across the sunlight onto the window ledge and cocked his head at me. His eye was round and bright. First he'd watch me with one eye, then flick, and it would be the other one, his throat pumping faster than any pulse. The hour began to strike. The sparrow quit swapping eyes and watched me steadily with the same one until the chimes ceased, as if he were listening too. Then he flicked off the ledge and was gone. It was a while before the last stroke ceased vibrating. It stayed in the air, more felt than heard, for a long time. Like all the bells that ever rang, still ringing in the long dying light rays, and Jesus and St. Francis talking about his sister. Because if it were just to hell, if that were all of it, finished, if things just finished themselves, nobody else there but her and me, if we could just have done something so dreadful that they would have fled hell except us. I have committed incest, I said. Father, it was I, it was not Dalton Ames. And when he put Dalton Ames, Dalton Ames, Dalton Ames, when he put the pistol in my hand, I didn't. That's why I didn't. He would be there, and she would, and I would. Dalton Ames, Dalton Ames, Dalton Ames. If we could have just done something so dreadful, and Father said, that's sad too, people cannot do anything that dreadful. They cannot do anything very dreadful at all. They cannot even remember tomorrow what seemed dreadful today. And I said, you can shirk all things, and he said, ah, can you? And I will look down and see my murmuring bones in the deep water like wind, like a roof of wind. And after a long time they cannot distinguish even bones upon the lonely and inviolate sand. Until on the day when he says rise, only the flat iron would come floating up. It's not when you realize that nothing can help you, religion, pride, anything. It's when you realize that you don't need any aid. Dalton Ames. Dalton Ames, Dalton Ames, if I could have been his mother lying with open body lifted laughing, holding his father with my hand, refraining, seeing, watching him die before he lived. 1 minute she was standing in the door. I went to the dresser and took up the watch, with the face still down. I tapped the crystal on the corner of the dresser and caught the fragments of glass in my hand and put them into the ashtray and twisted the hands off and put them in the tray. The watch ticked on. I turned the face up, the blank dial with little wheels clicking and clicking behind it, not knowing any better. Jesus walking on Galilee and Washington not telling lies. Father brought back a watch charm from the St. Louis Fair to Jason. A tiny opera glass into which you squinted with one eye and saw a skyscraper, a Ferris wheel all spidery, Niagara Falls on a pinhead. There was a red smear on the dial. When I saw it, my thumb began to smart. I put the watch down and went into Shreve's room and got the iodine and painted the cut. I cleaned the rest of the glass out of the rim with a towel. I laid out 2 suits of underwear with socks, shirts, collars, and ties, and packed my trunk. I put in everything except my new suit and an old one and 2 pairs of shoes and 2 hats and my books. I carried the books into the sitting room and stacked them on the table, the ones I had brought from home and the ones... Father said it used to be a gentleman was known by his books. Nowadays he is known by the ones he has not returned. And locked the trunk and addressed it. The quarter hour sounded. I stopped and listened to it until the chimes ceased. I bathed and shaved. The water made my fingers smart a little, so I painted it again. I put on my new suit and put my watch on, and packed the other suit and the accessories and my razor and brushes in my handbag, and folded the trunk key into a sheet of paper and put it in an envelope and addressed it to Father, and wrote the two notes and sealed them. The shadow hadn't quite cleared the stoop. I stopped inside the door, watching the shadow move. It moved almost perceptibly, creeping back inside the door, driving the shadow back into the door. Only she was running already when I heard it. In the mirror she was running before I knew what it was. That quick, her train caught up over her arm, she ran out of the mirror like a cloud, her veil swirling in long glints, her heels brittle and fast, clutching her dress onto her shoulder with the other hand, running out of the mirror, the smells, roses, roses, the voice that breathed o'er Eden. Then she was across the porch, I couldn't hear her heels, then in the moonlight like a cloud, the floating shadow of the veil running across the grass, into the bellowing. She ran out of her dress, clutching her bridle, running into the bellowing where Teepee in the dew, hoo-ee, sarsaparilla, Benji under the box, bellowing. Father had a V-shaped silver cuirass on his running chest. Shreve said, "Well, you didn't. Is it a wedding or a wake?" "I couldn't make it," I said. "Not with all that primping. What's the matter? You think this was Sunday?" "I reckon the police won't get me for wearing my new suit one time," I said. "I was thinking about the square students. They'll think you go to Harvard. Have you got too proud to attend classes, too?" "I'm going to eat first." The shadow on the stoop was gone. I stepped into sunlight, finding my shadow again. I walked down the steps just ahead of it. The half hour went. Then the chimes ceased and died away. Deacon wasn't at the post office either. I stamped the two envelopes and mailed the one to Father and put Shreve's in my inside pocket. And then I remembered where I had last seen the deacon. It was on Decoration Day, in a GAR uniform in the middle of the parade. If you waited long enough on any corner, you would see him in whatever parade came along. The one before was on Columbus's or Garibaldi's or somebody's birthday. He was in the street sweeper's section, in a stovepipe hat, carrying a 2-inch Italian flag, smoking a cigar among the brooms and scoops. But the last time was the GAR one, because Shreve said, "There now, just look at what your grandpa did to that poor old nigger." "Yes," I said, "now he can spend day after day marching in parades. If it hadn't been for my grandfather, he'd have to work like white folks." I didn't see him anywhere. But I never knew even a working nigger that you could find when you wanted him, let alone one that lived off the fat of the land. A car came along. I went over to town and went to Parker's and had a good breakfast. While I was eating, I heard a clock strike the hour. But then I suppose it takes at least 1 hour to lose time in, who has been longer than history, getting into the mechanical progression of it. When I finished breakfast, I bought a cigar. The girl said a 50-cent one was the best, so I took one and lit it and went out to the street. I stood there and took a couple of puffs, then I held it in my hand and went on toward the corner. I passed a jeweler's window, but I looked away in time. At the corner, two bootblacks caught me, one on either side, shrill and raucous like blackbirds. I gave the cigar to one of them and the other one a nickel. Then they let me alone. The one with the cigar was trying to sell it to the other for the nickel. There was a clock high up in the sun, and I thought about how, when you don't want to do a thing, your body will try to trick you into doing it, sort of unawares. I could feel the muscles in the back of my neck, and then I could hear my watch ticking away in my pocket. And after a while I had all the other sounds shut away, leaving only the watch in my pocket. I turned back up the street, to the window. He was working at the table behind the window. He was going bald. There was a glass in his eye. A metal tube screwed into his face. I went in. The place was full of ticking, like crickets in September grass, and I could hear a big clock on the wall above his head. He looked up, his eye big and blurred and rushing beyond the glass. I took mine out and handed it to him. "I broke my watch." He flipped it over in his hand. "I should say you have. You must have stepped on it." Yes, sir. I knocked it off the dresser and stepped on it in the dark. It's still running, though. He pried the back open and squinted into it. Seems to be all right. I can't tell until I go over it, though. I'll go into it this afternoon. I'll bring it back later, I said. Would you mind telling me if any of those watches in the window are right? He held my watch in his palm and looked up at me with his blurred, rushing eye. I made a bet with the fellow, I said, and I forgot my glasses this morning. Why, all right, he said. He laid the watch down and half rose on his stool and looked over the barrier. Then he glanced up at the wall. It's don't tell me, I said. Please, sir, just tell me if any of them are right. He looked at me again. He sat back on the stool and pushed the glass up onto his forehead. It left a red circle around his eye, and when it was gone, his whole face looked naked. What are you celebrating today? He said. That boat race ain't until next week, is it? No, sir, this is just a private celebration. Birthday. Are any of them right? No, but they haven't been regulated and set yet, if you're thinking of buying one of them. No, sir, I don't need a watch. We have a clock in our sitting room. I'll have this one fixed when I do. I reached my hand. Better leave it now. I'll bring it back later. He gave me the watch. I put it in my pocket. I couldn't hear it now above all the others. I'm much obliged to you. I hope I haven't taken up your time. That's all right. Bring it in when you are ready. And you better put off this celebration until after we win that boat race. Yes, sir, I reckon I had. I went out, shutting the door upon the ticking. I looked back into the window. He was watching me across the barrier. There were about a dozen watches in the window, a dozen different hours, and each with the same assertive and contradictory assurance that mine had, without any hands at all, contradicting one another. I could hear mine ticking away inside my pocket, even though nobody could see it, even though it could tell nothing if anyone could. And so I told myself to take that one, because Father said clocks slay time. He said time is dead as long as it is being clicked off by little wheels. Only when the clock stops does time come to life. The hands were extended, slightly off the horizontal at a faint angle, like a gull tilting into the wind. Holding all I used to be sorry about, like the new moon holding water, niggers say. The jeweler was working again, bent over his bench, the tube tunneled into his face. His hair was parted in the center. The part ran up into the bald spot, like a drained marsh in December. I saw the hardware store from across the street. I didn't know you bought flat irons by the pound. Maybe you want a tailor's goose, the clerk said. They weigh 10 pounds. Only they were bigger than I thought, so I got 2 6-pound little ones because they would look like a pair of shoes wrapped up. They felt heavy enough together, but I thought again how Father had said about the reducto absurdum of human experience, thinking how the only opportunity I seemed to have for the application of Harvard. Maybe by next year, thinking maybe it takes 2 years in school to learn to do that properly. But they felt heavy enough in the air. A car came. I got on. I didn't see the placard on the front. It was full, mostly prosperous-looking people reading newspapers. The only vacant seat was beside a nigger. He wore a derby and shined shoes, and he was holding a dead cigar stub. I used to think that a southerner had to be always conscious of niggers. I thought that northerners would expect him to. When I first came east, I kept thinking, you've got to remember to think of them as colored people, not niggers. And if it hadn't happened that I wasn't thrown with many of them, I'd have wasted a lot of time and trouble before I learned that the best way to take all people, black or white, is to take them for what they think they are, then leave them alone. That was when I realized that a nigger is not a person so much as a form of behavior, a sort of obverse reflection of the white people he lives among. But I thought at first that I ought to miss having a lot of them around me because I thought that northerners thought I did. But I didn't know that I really had missed Roscus and Dilsey and them until that morning in Virginia. The train was stopped when I waked, and I raised the shade and looked out. The car was blocking a road crossing where two white fences came down a hill and then sprayed outward and downward like part of the skeleton of a horn. And there was a nigger on a mule in the middle of the stiff ruts, waiting for the train to move. How long he had been there, I didn't know, but he sat straddle of the mule, his head wrapped in a piece of blanket, as if they had been built there with the fence and the road, or with the hill, carved out of the hill itself, like a sign put there saying, "You are home again." He didn't have a saddle, and his feet dangled almost to the ground. The mule looked like a rabbit. I raised the window. "Hey, uncle," I said, "is this the way?" "Sir?" He looked at me, then he loosened the blanket and lifted it away from his ear. "Christmas gift," I said. "Sure coming, boss. You done caught me, ain't you?" "I'll let you off this time." I dragged my pants out of the little hammock and got a quarter out. "But look out next time. I'll be coming back through here 2 days after New Year, and look out then." I threw the quarter out the window. "Buy yourself some Santa Claus." "Yes, sir," he said. He got down and picked up the quarter and rubbed it on his leg. "Thank you, young master. Thank you." Then the train began to move. I leaned out the window into the cold air, looking back. He stood there beside the gaunt rabbit of a mule, the two of them shabby and motionless and unimpatient. The train swung around the curve, the engine puffing with short, heavy blasts, and they passed smoothly from sight that way, with that quality about them of shabby and timeless patience, of static serenity, that blending of childlike and ready incompetence and paradoxical reliability that tends and protects them. It loves out of all reason and robs them steadily and evades responsibility and obligations by means too barefaced to be called subterfuge even, and is taken in theft or evasion with only that frank and spontaneous admiration for the victor which a gentleman feels for anyone who beats him in a fair contest, and with all a fond and unflagging tolerance for white folks' vagaries like that of a grandparent for unpredictable and troublesome children, which I had forgotten. And all that day, while the train wound through rushing gaps and along ledges where movement was only a laboring sound of the exhaust and groaning wheels, and the eternal mountains stood fading into the thick sky, I thought of home, of the bleak station and the mud and the niggers and country folks thronging slowly about the square, with toy monkeys and wagons and candy and sacks and Roman candles sticking out, and my insides would move like they used to do in school when the bell rang. I wouldn't begin counting until the clock struck 3. Then I would begin, counting to 16 and folding down one finger and thinking of the other 14 fingers waiting to be folded down, or 13, or 12, or 8, or 7, until all of a sudden I'd realize silence and the unwinking minds, and I'd say, "Ma'am?" "Your name is Quentin, isn't it?" Miss Laura would say. Then more silence and the cruel unwinking minds and hands jerking into the silence. "Tell Quentin who discovered the Mississippi River, Henry." "De Soto." Then the mines would go away, and after a while I'd be afraid I'd gotten behind, and I'd count fast and fold down another finger. Then I'd be afraid I was going too fast, and I'd slow up. Then I'd get afraid and count fast again. So I never could come out even with the bell, and the released surging of feet moving already, feeling earth in the scuffed floor, and the day like a pane of glass struck a light sharp blow. And my insides would move, sitting still. Moving, sitting still, my bowels moved for thee. 1 minute she was standing in the door. Benji, bellowing. Benjamin, the child of mine old age, bellowing. "Caddy, Caddy." "I'm going to run away." He began to cry. She went and touched him. "Hush, I'm not going to. Hush." He hushed. "Dilsey." "He smell what you tell him when he want to. Don't have to listen or talk. Can he smell that new name they give him? Can he smell bad luck?" "What he want to worry about luck for? Luck can't do him no hurt." "What they change his name for then, if ain't trying to help his luck?" The car stopped, started, stopped again. Below the window, I watched the crowns of people's heads passing beneath new straw hats not yet unbleached. There were women in the car now, with market baskets, and men in work clothes were beginning to outnumber the shined shoes and collars. The nigger touched my knee. "Pardon me," he said. I swung my legs out and let him pass. We were going beside a blank wall, the sound clattering back into the car, at the women with market baskets on their knees, and a man in a stained hat with a pipe stuck in the band. I could smell water. And in a break in the wall I saw a glint of water and two masts, and a gull motionless in midair, like on an invisible wire between the masts. And I raised my hand and threw my coat, touched the letters I had written. When the car stopped, I got off. The bridge was open to let a schooner through. She was in tow, the tug nudging along under her quarter, trailing smoke, but the ship herself was like she was moving without visible means. A man naked to the waist was coiling down a line on the forecastle head. His body was burned the color of leaf tobacco. Another man in a straw hat without any crown was at the wheel. The ship went through the bridge, moving under bare poles like a ghost in broad day, with three gulls hovering above the stern like toys on invisible wires. When it closed, I crossed to the other side and leaned on the rail above the boathouses. The float was empty and the doors were closed. Crew just pulled in the late afternoon now, resting up before. The shadow of the bridge, the tiers of railing, my shadow leaning flat upon the water. So easily had I tricked it that it would not quit me. At least 50 feet it was, and if I only had something to blot it into the water, holding it until it was drowned, the shadow of the package like two shoes wrapped up lying on the water. Niggers say a drowned man's shadow was watching for him in the water all the time. It twinkled and glinted, like breathing. The float slow like breathing, too, and debris half-submerged, heeling out to the sea and the caverns and the grottos of the sea. The displacement of water is equal to the something of something. Reducto absurdum of all human experience. And 2 6-pound flat irons weigh more than one tailor's goose. What a sinful waste, Dilsey would say. Benji knew it when Damity died. He cried. He smell it. He smell it. The tug came back downstream, the water shearing in long rolling cylinders, rocking the float at last with the echo of passage. The float lurching onto the rolling cylinder with a plopping sound and a long jarring noise as the door rolled back and two men emerged, carrying a shell. They set it in the water, and a moment later Bland came out, with the sculls. He wore flannels, a gray jacket, and a stiff straw hat. Either he or his mother had read somewhere that Oxford students pulled in flannels and stiff hats. So early one March they bought Gerald a one-pair shell, and in his flannels and stiff hat he went on the river. The folks at the boathouse threatened to call a policeman, but he went anyway. His mother came down in a hired auto, in a fur suit like an Arctic explorer's, and saw him off in a 25-mile wind and a steady drove of ice floes like dirty sheep. Ever since then I have believed that God is not only a gentleman and a sport, he is a Kentuckian, too. When he sailed away she made a detour and came down to the river again and drove along parallel with him, the car in low gear. They said you couldn't have told they'd ever seen one another before, like a king and queen, not even looking at one another, just moving side by side across Massachusetts on parallel courses, like a couple of planets. He got in and pulled away. He pulled pretty well now. He ought to. They said his mother tried to make him give rowing up and do something else the rest of his class couldn't or wouldn't do, but for once he was stubborn. If you could call it stubbornness, sitting in his attitudes of princely boredom, with his curly yellow hair and his violet eyes and his eyelashes and his New York clothes, while his mama was telling us about Gerald's horses and Gerald's niggers and Gerald's women. Husbands and fathers in Kentucky must have been awful glad when she carried Gerald off to Cambridge. She had an apartment over in town, and Gerald had one there, too, besides his rooms in college. She approved of Gerald associating with me because I at least revealed a blundering sense of noblesse oblige by getting myself born below Mason and Dixon, and a few others whose geography met the requirements, minimum. Forgave, at least, or condoned. But since she met Spode coming out of chapel one... He said she couldn't be a lady. No lady would be out at that hour of the night. She never had been able to forgive him for having 5 names, including that of a present English ducal house. I'm sure she solaced herself by being convinced that some misfit Mingault or Mortimer had got mixed up with the lodgekeeper's daughter, which was quite probable, whether she invented it or not. Spode was the world's champion sitter around, no holds barred and gouging discretionary. The shell was a speck now, the oars catching the sun in spaced glints, as if the hull were winking itself along, him along. "Did you ever have a sister?" "No, but they're all bitches. Did you ever have a sister?" 1 minute she was. Bitches. Not bitch. 1 minute she stood in the door. Dalton Ames. Dalton Ames. Dalton shirts. I thought all the time they were khaki, army-issue khaki, until I saw they were of heavy Chinese silk or finest flannel, because they made his face so brown, his eyes so blue. Dalton Ames. It just missed gentility. Theatrical fixture. Just papier-mâché, then touch. Oh, asbestos. Not quite bronze. But won't see him at the house. Caddy's a woman, too, remember. She must do things for women's reasons, too. Why won't you bring him to the house, Caddy? Why must you do like nigger women do in the pasture, the ditches, the dark woods, hot, hidden, furious in the dark woods? And after a while I had been hearing my watch for some time, and I could feel the letters crackle through my coat, against the railing, and I leaned on the railing, watching my shadow, how I had tricked it. I moved along the rail, but my suit was dark too, and I could wipe my hands, watching my shadow, how I had tricked it. I walked it into the shadow of the quay. Then I went east.
This book is continued on Disc 3.
And after a while I had been hearing my watch for some time, and I could feel the letters crackle through my coat, against the railing, and I leaned on the railing, watching my shadow, how I had tricked it. I moved along the rail, but my suit was dark too, and I could wipe my hands, watching my shadow, how I had tricked it. I walked it into the shadow of the quay. Then I went east. Harvard, my Harvard boy, Harvard, Harvard. That pimple-faced infant she met at the field meet with colored ribbons, skulking along the fence trying to whistle her out like a puppy. Because they couldn't cajole him into the dining room, Mother believed he had some sort of spell he was going to cast on her when he got her alone. Yet any blackguard... He was lying beside the box under the window, bellowing, that could drive up in a limousine with a flower in his buttonhole. Harvard. Quentin, this is Herbert. My Harvard boy. Herbert will be a big brother, has already promised Jason. Hearty, celluloid like a drummer, face full of teeth, white but not smiling. I've heard of him up there. All teeth but not smiling. You going to drive? Get in, Quentin. You going to drive? It's her car. Aren't you proud of your little sister? Owns first auto in town. Herbert, his present. Lewis has been giving her lessons every morning. Didn't you get my letter? Mr. and Mrs. Jason Richmond Compson announced the marriage of their daughter Candace to Mr. Sidney Herbert Head on the 25th of April, 1910, at Jefferson, Mississippi. At home, after the 1st of August, number something-something, Avenue South Bend, Indiana. Shreve said, aren't you even going to open it? 3 days. Times. Mr. and Mrs. Jason Richmond Compson. Young Lochinvar rode out of the West a little too soon, didn't he? I'm from the South. You're funny, aren't you? Oh, yes, I knew it was somewhere in the country. You're funny, aren't you? You ought to join the circus. I did. That's how I ruined my eyes, watering the elephant's fleas. 3 times. These country girls, you can't ever tell about them, can you? Well, anyway, Byron never had his wish, thank God. But not hit a man in glasses. Aren't you even going to open it? It lay on the table, a candle burning at each corner upon the envelope, tied in a soiled pink garter, 2 artificial flowers. Not hit a man in glasses. Country people, poor things, they never saw an auto before, lots of them. Honk the horn, Candace, so... She wouldn't look at me. They'll get out of the way. Wouldn't look at me. Your father wouldn't like it if you were to injure one of them. I'll declare your father will simply have to get an auto now. I'm almost sorry you brought it down, Herbert. I've enjoyed it so much. Of course, there's the carriage. But so often, when I'd like to go out, Mr. Compson has the darkies doing something it would be worth my head to interrupt. He insists that Roscus is at my call all the time, but I know what that means. I know how often people make promises just to satisfy their consciences. Are you going to treat my little baby girl that way, Herbert? But I know you won't. Herbert has spoiled us all to death. Quentin, did I write you that he's going to take Jason into his bank when Jason finishes high school? Jason will make a splendid banker. He is the only one of my children with any practical sense. You can thank me for that. He takes after my people. The others are all Compson. Jason furnished the flower. They made kites on the back porch and sold them for a nickel apiece, he and the Patterson boy. Jason was treasurer. There was no nigger in this car, and the hats, unbleached as yet, flowing past under the window. Going to Harvard. We have sold Benji's... He lay on the ground under the window, bellowing. We have sold Benji's pasture so that Quentin may go to Harvard. A brother to you, your little brother. You should have a car. It's done you no end of good, don't you think so, Quentin? I call him Quentin at once. You see, I have heard so much about him from Candace. Why shouldn't you? I want my boys to be more than friends. Yes, Candace and Quentin, more than friends. Father, I have committed. What a pity you had no brother or sister. No sister, no sister, had no sister. Don't ask Quentin. He and Mr. Compson both feel a little insulted. When I'm strong enough to come down to the table, I'm going on nerve now. I'll pay for it after it's all over and you've taken my little daughter away from me. My little sister had no... If I could say mother. Mother. Unless I do what I am tempted to and take you instead, I don't think Mr. Compson could overtake the car. Ah, Herbert, Candace, do you hear that? She wouldn't look at me, soft, stubborn jaw angle, not back-looking. You needn't be jealous, though. It's just an old woman he's flattering, a grown married daughter. I can't believe it. Nonsense, you look like a girl. You're a lot younger than Candace, color in your cheeks like a girl. A face reproachful, tearful, an odor of camphor and of tears, a voice weeping steadily and softly beyond the twilit door, the twilight-colored smell of honeysuckle. Bringing empty trunks down the attic stairs, they sounded like coffins, French lick. Found not death at the salt lick. Hats, not unbleached, and not hats. In 3 years I cannot wear a hat. I could not. Was. Will there be hats then, since I was not, and not Harvard then? Where the best of thought, father said, clings like dead ivy vines upon old dead brick. Not Harvard then, not to me anyway. Again. Sadder than was. Again. Saddest of all. Again. Spode had a shirt on, then it must be. When I can see my shadow again, if not careful, that I tricked into the water, shall tread again upon my impervious shadow. But no, sister. I wouldn't have done it. I won't have my daughter spied on. I wouldn't have. How can I control any of them when you have always taught them to have no respect for me and my wishes? I know you look down on my people, but is that any reason for teaching my children, my own children I suffered for, to have no respect? Trampling my shadow's bones into the concrete with hard heels, and then I was hearing the watch, and I touched the letters through my coat. I will not have my daughter spied on by you or Quentin or anybody, no matter what you think she has done. At least you agree there is reason for having her watched. I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have. I know you wouldn't. I didn't mean to speak so sharply, but women have no respect for each other, for themselves. But why did she... The chimes began as I stepped on my shadow, but it was the quarter hour. The deacon wasn't in sight anywhere. Think I would have... Could have. She didn't mean that that's the way women do things. It's because she loves Caddy. The street lamps would go down the hill, then rise toward town. I walked upon the belly of my shadow. I could extend my hand beyond it. Feeling farther behind me, beyond the rasping darkness of summer and August, the street lamps. Father and I protect women from one another, from themselves, our women... Women are like that. They don't acquire knowledge of people we are, for that they are just born with a practical fertility of suspicion that makes a crop every so often, and usually right. They have an affinity for evil, for supplying whatever the evil lacks in itself, for drawing it about them instinctively as you do bed clothing in slumber, fertilizing the mind for it, until the evil has served its purpose whether it ever existed or no. He was coming along between a couple of freshmen. He hadn't quite recovered from the parade, for he gave me a salute, a very superior officerish kind. "I want to see you a minute," I said, stopping. "See me? All right. See you again, fellows," he said, stopping and turning back. "Glad to have chatted with you." That was the deacon all over. Talk about your natural psychologists. They said he hadn't missed a train at the beginning of school in 40 years, and that he could pick out a southerner with one glance. He never missed, and once he had heard you speak, he could name your state. He had a regular uniform he met trains in, a sort of Uncle Tom's cabin outfit, patches and all. "Yes, sir, right this way, young master, here we is," taking your bags. "Here, boy, come here and get these grips." Whereupon a moving mountain of luggage would edge up, revealing a white boy of about 15, and the deacon would hang another bag on him somehow and drive him off. "Now then, don't you drap it." "Yes, sir, young master, just give the old nigger your room number, and it'll be done got cold dar when you arrives." From then on, until he had you completely subjugated, he was always in or out of your room, ubiquitous and garrulous, though his manner gradually moved northward as his raiment improved, until at last, when he had bled you until you began to learn better, he was calling you Quentin or whatever, and when you saw him next he'd be wearing a cast-off brook suit and a hat with a Princeton club, I forget which band, that someone had given him, and which he was pleasantly and unshakably convinced was a part of Abe Lincoln's military sash. Someone spread the story years ago, when he first appeared around college from wherever he came from, that he was a graduate of the Divinity School. And when he came to understand what it meant, he was so taken with it that he began to retail the story himself, until at last he must have come to believe he really had. Anyway, he related long pointless anecdotes of his undergraduate days, speaking familiarly of dead and departed professors by their first names, usually incorrect ones. But he had been guide, mentor, and friend to unnumbered crops of innocent and lonely freshmen, and I suppose that with all his petty chicanery and hypocrisy, he stank no higher in heaven's nostrils than any other. "Haven't seen you in 3-4 days," he said, staring at me from his still military aura. "You been sick?" "No, I've been all right. Working, I reckon. I've seen you, though." "Yes?" "In the parade the other day." "Oh, that. Yes, I was there. I don't care nothing about that sort of thing, you understand, but the boys likes to have me with 'em, the veterans does. Ladies wants all the old veterans to turn out, you know, so I has to oblige them." "And on that WAP holiday, too," I said. "You were obliging the WCTU then, I reckon." "That? I was doing that for my son-in-law. He aims to get a job on the city forces, street cleaner. I tells him all he wants is a broom to sleep on. You saw me, did you?"
"Both times, yes.
I mean in uniform. How'd I look?"
"You looked fine. You looked better than any of them. They ought to make you a general, Deacon."
He touched my arm, lightly, his hand that worn, gentle quality of niggers' hands. "Listen, this ain't for outside talking. I don't mind telling you, because you and me's the same folks, come long and short."
He leaned a little to me, speaking rapidly, his eyes not looking at me. "I've got strings out right now. Wait till next year. Just wait. Then see where I'm marching. I won't need to tell you how I'm fixing it. I say just wait and see, my boy."
He looked at me now and clapped me lightly on the shoulder and rocked back on his heels, nodding at me.
"Yes, sir, I didn't turn Democrat 3 years ago for nothing. My son-in-law on the city? Me? Yes, sir, if just turning Democrat'll make that son of a bitch go to work. And me, just you stand on that corner yonder a year from 2 days ago and see."
"I hope so. You deserve it, Deacon. And while I think about it..." I took the letter from my pocket. "Take this around to my room tomorrow and give it to Shreve. He'll have something for you, but not till tomorrow, mind."
He took the letter and examined it.
"It's sealed up."
"Yes, and it's written inside. Not good until tomorrow."
"Hmm," he said. He looked at the envelope, his mouth pursed.
"Something for me, you say?"
"Yes, a present I'm making you." He was looking at me now, the envelope white in his black hand, in the sun. His eyes were soft and irisless and brown. And suddenly I saw Roscus watching me from behind all his white folks' claptrap of uniforms and politics and Harvard manner, diffident, secret, inarticulate, and sad.
"You ain't playing a joke on the old nigger, is you?"
"You know I'm not. Did any Southerner ever play a joke on you?"
"You're right, they're fine folks, but you can't live with them."
"Did you ever try?" I said. But Roscus was gone. Once more he was that self he had long since taught himself to wear in the world's eye, pompous, spurious, not quite gross.
"I'll confer to your wishes, my boy. Not until tomorrow, remember. Sure, he said. Understood, my boy. Well?
I hope, I said. He looked down at me, benignant, profound. Suddenly I held out my hand, and we shook, he gravely, from the pompous height of his municipal and military dream.
You're a good fellow, Deacon, I hope. You've helped a lot of young fellows here and there.
I've tried to treat all folks right, he said. I draw no petty social lines. A man to me is a man, wherever I find him.
I hope you'll always find as many friends as you've made.
Young fellows, I get along with them. They don't forget me neither, he said, waving the envelope. He put it into his pocket and buttoned his coat. Yes, sir, he said, I've had good friends.
The chimes began again, the half hour. I stood in the belly of my shadow and listened to the strokes, spaced and tranquil along the sunlight, among the thin, still little leaves, spaced and peaceful and serene, with that quality of autumn always in bells, even in the month of brides. Lying on the ground under the window, bellowing. He took one look at her and knew, out of the mouths of babes, the street lamps. The chimes ceased. I went back to the post office, treading my shadow into pavement. Go down the hill, then they rise toward town like lanterns hung one above another on a wall. Father said because she loves Caddy, she loves people through their shortcomings. Uncle Maury, straddling his legs before the fire, must remove one hand long enough to drink Christmas. Jason ran on. His hands in his pockets fell down and lay there like a trussed fowl until Verse set him up. Why don't you keep them hands out in your pockets when you runnin', you could stand up then? Rolling his head in the cradle, rolling it flat across the back. Caddy told Jason and Verse that the reason Uncle Maury didn't work was that he used to roll his head in the cradle when he was little. Shreve was coming up the walk, shambling, fatly earnest, his glasses glinting beneath the running leaves like little pools. I gave Deacon a note for some things. I may not be in this afternoon, so don't you let him have anything until tomorrow, will you?
All right.
He looked at me.
Say, what are you doing today, anyhow? All dressed up and mooning around like the prologue to a settee. Did you go to psychology this morning?